WBUR. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Is there an autism epidemic in America? A new study released in California last week suggests there may be. The University of California study concluded that the number of children with profound autism receiving services from that state has almost tripled in the past 15 years, and that kind of increase makes autism look like an epidemic. Medical experts cannot explain why. It's not due to a population boom or a new, broader definition of the disorder that's pumped up the numbers. The fact is that there's been a 273% increase in autism cases in California alone. And with no cure, no vaccine, and no definitive cause for the disorder, doctors are at a loss. But parents want answers. Has autism hit close to home for you or someone you know? And can a disorder with no definitive cause really become an epidemic? Is the tragic mystery of autism the price our children pay for an environment deluged with chemicals? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Marion Sigmund, professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of California in Los Angeles and one of the investigators in the California Autism Study. Good evening and welcome, Marion Sigmund.
Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us. Marion, take us into this study, if you would. Why was it commissioned and what was the question? California knew how many cases were in the system, so what was the study required for?
Okay, what you described, the increase in cases,
yes,
was actually described several years ago by the Department of Developmental Services at California. The increase is an increase in the percentage of kids at the regional centers, and the regional centers are the place where our kids in California get
assessed. So they knew the regional centers were being flooded with new cases.
They knew that the percentage of cases that the regional centers were getting that were attributable to autism had increased a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The regional centers were getting more kids overall, and proportionally more of them had autism.
So what were you looking for in this study then?
So one of the questions was this increase in this group of children due to changes in diagnosis? How accurate were the diagnoses that the regional centers were making? Did that change?
In other words, was the number larger or the percentage increased there simply because they were diagnosing more effectively and more widely?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so the major finding of the study is that the regional centers, what we did was we looked at two different cohorts of children. One was a group of children who were born in the early 80s, and the other group was a group of children born about 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at we interviewed the parents with a measure called the Autism Diagnostic Interview.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked to see whether we agreed with their diagnosis of the children who were autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was that the regional centers were very accurate. I think the percentage, I'm not exactly sure of these numbers, but I think this is right. The percentage was 88% for the older children. And it was 89% that we agreed with them in the diagnosis for the younger children.
So it wasn't an elastic or erratic diagnosis that was driving up the number.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what else did you look for?
Okay, and we looked to see whether it had to do with families moving into California for California services.
Because California offers more plentiful services, they might come there to take advantage of those.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that the majority of the children were born in California, and that was the same for both groups.
So it's not that they're moving to California.
Right. So those are the two answers that we gave. What we did not look at, and what would be a very, very different and much more difficult study to do, we did not look at whether or not, and it's hard to know how you do this, but we did not look at whether more parents were bringing their children to the regional centers. More parents of children with autism were bringing their children to the regional centers for assessment.
So it might simply be a greater awareness or for whatever reason, a greater willingness or motivation to come forward with these kids.
Right. So we can't say, we can say that there's a rise in the percentage of children.
Mm-hmm.
We can say that the numbers now, the incidence that we get from the regional centers now is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like what we had before was an underestimate.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers that we're getting now for prevalence and incidence, these numbers are accurate because the regional centers are diagnosing their children effectively.
So, Marion Sigmund, when you as a medical researcher look at that kind of increase, what does it say to you?
We don't know whether it's a true increase in cases.
Because there's this last door left open about whether parents are bringing their children in at a greater rate.
Because there's more awareness about mm-hmm. autism now, and doctors may be suggesting to parents that they bring their kids in, and parents may be bringing in. So we can't for sure say that there's actually a rise in the syndrome itself. But we do know that the higher prevalence rates that we're seeing now are true, that there must have been underestimates before.
As with always with these medical stories, there's a lot of complexity here. The headline that comes out is, boom, epidemic. How do you respond to that?
I think you have to be careful about the word epidemic, because if you say that there's an epidemic, it means that you think you're absolutely sure that there actually has been a real rise,
mm-hmm.
that there's an increasing, you know, this is really increasing in incidence, and as I said, we still have this question about differential referral rates.
Right.
And the other thing about epidemic is that it's generally used. I looked it up in the dictionary yesterday. It's generally used for an illness where there's contagion, and, you know, that's just not happening here. So I think the word epidemic is not an appropriate word to use.
Though it's amazing how many people in the autism circle have been using it. What is behind this heavy incidence, epidemic or not, Marion Sigmund? What's going on here?
This just turns out to be a disorder that more people have than we thought before, and you know, I mean that certainly seems to be true. But to try and look for causes when you're not sure that there's a rise, you know, I mean, we want to look for causes of autism. It's very, very important to look for causes of autism. But I don't think it needs to be linked to an epidemic.
Now, epidemic aside, just simply looking at the heavy incidence that you describe, where are scientists in California and elsewhere looking for the root, for the cause here?
Well, there are now a number of new studies that are beginning to look at environmental factors, looking at children's birth history, looking at their exposure to teratogens.
To what? I'm sorry, I didn't catch.
Teratogens.
Those being?
Well, substances that are not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we're continuing the work that looks at genetic causes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at environmental causes and we're looking at genetic causes because we can't rule out that any of these, in fact, there's evidence that certainly that genetic factors have, you know, play a part in this. And there may be environmental factors as well.
What kind of environmental factors are people examining?
People are looking at exposure to various chemicals in the environment. They're looking at...
Are we talking lead or chemicals in food or
right.
medical
all,
medicines?
Yeah, all of those kinds of things. Because there are a variety of different studies that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you realize that there are people we are looking at immunization histories.
That is vaccinations and whether they might be a potential cause of autism.
Right.
Any particular vaccination that's under the microscope?
Well, the one that people are most concerned about is the MMR vaccine.
That's mumps.
Measles, mumps, and rubella.
Mm-hmm.
But right at this point, you know, this is really something that we need to study. We could not study it in our study. Bob Bird, who is the PI of this study,
mm-hmm.
estimated the sample size we would need to be able to answer that question, and he came up that we would need 7,000 children in our study, and we had 700, about half of whom had autism. So we were far below the power to be able to answer that question.
But in California overall, you have how many cases in the system now of autism?
I think in the regional centers it's something like 18,000.
18,000, and nationally we read something 125,000 or something on that order.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a treatment under development, or is treatment advancing? What about the other end of the equation here?
We're working very hard to come up with interventions that are effective. We have a variety of different interventions that are being used, and there's a big movement to test those interventions and to develop new interventions that are more connected to the syndrome. I'm losing my voice, so I think I might have to get off.
So let me just get that. The last question, the interventions, meaning
various treatment, kinds of treatments.
Pharmaceutical, medicines?
Both, yes, both. We are both looking at pharmacological treatments, and we're also looking at we're also looking at various kinds of behavioral interventions. Mm-hmm. There's been a history of a behavioral intervention with autism, and some evidence that it is effective with some children, and there's a big movement now to look at those treatments more. I have to get off now.
Got it. Marion Sigmund, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, bye.
Marion Sigmund is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of California in Los Angeles and one of the investigators of the California Autism Study. We're talking tonight about autism in America. Has autism hit home close to you or someone you know? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Joseph Ricciardi, Vice President of Clinical Training and Education at the May Institute. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Ricciardi.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. You've just heard Marion Sigmund in California tell us that the autism situation there is in a lot of flux. They've got much bigger numbers than they had 15 years ago. What does this mean for parents, for schools around the nation?
Well, I think as a researcher told us, it's something that needs to be continually studied because the exact cause of that isn't quite known. But what is clear is it wasn't simply a matter of changing diagnostic criteria, poor diagnosis, or kids moving into the state. There are still some other concerns, as you heard, the increasing awareness, which is actually a good thing, because years ago, parents of children with autism failed to get diagnosis early, and we do know that the earlier the diagnosis, the better the chance for the child developing skills and maybe overcoming some aspects of the autism.
Now, your organization is active nationally. Given the California study, given what you see nationally, do you see trends that reflect or suggest this sharp spike, this sharp rise in the incidence of autism?
Well, we provide services to children. We provide a whole range of special education services. We consult with school systems. And I can tell you one thing is we're very busy. We have plenty of work to do, and there are plenty of families looking for our services. So if that's any corroboration, then we do find that as well.
Joseph Ricciardi, not everyone has had direct experience of autism in their family or even in their immediate circle. Define it for us to the extent that you can.
Sure.
What is it? How does it show up in a child's life, in a family's life?
Sure. Well, there's a cluster of three symptom patterns that you see in autism. And the first is that they have real impairments in social interaction, manifested very, very early, in most cases before age one. Things like failure to orient to face and sustained eye contact with a parent, even pro-social responding. You do find in infants, they make attempts to engage their parent and make contact with the parent. So that's the first thing that you see. And then communication impairments, the failure to develop or maybe just develop only a small bit of language, failure to be able to sustain conversation or the use of language in a very inappropriate, idiosyncratic way, one or two words repetitively.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, development also very early on is stereotyped movements and patterns of behavior, things like restricted interest, using a toy for spinning its wheels rather than as a truck, what any other child might do.
So for people who don't have a direct experience but might have seen the movie, I guess some decade ago now with Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man, was that a reasonable kind of depiction or was that a Hollywood exaggeration?
No, Rain Man would depict some of the features that we see. He's much higher functioning than the typical cases that we work with, and he would have, of course, all of those things, but in the not so dramatic sense. But his early development would probably look like I described. You know, overall, you'd see that he just failed to develop, and a child with autism fails to develop the expected social interactions that we see in other children their age.
Joseph Ricciardi, stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about autism and big numbers in America. What's going on here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about autism and big numbers of children with autism in America. Is there anything more unsettling than an affliction without an apparent cause? And do you fear that somehow this is a price children are paying for our chemically bathed environment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined right now by Joseph Ricciardi. He's Vice President of Clinical Training and Education at the May Institute. It's a nonprofit organization that operates schools for children and adolescents with autism. Joseph Ricciardi, you were describing how autism shows up, comes into a child's life, into a family's life. It's usually before age three that we have the onset. Has that been fairly consistent?
Actually, it's probably even earlier. Most of the cases are showing signs before age one. And what typically happens is the pattern emerges to the parent who brings the information to the pediatrician, mm-hmm. who tends to, at least in the past, to kind of write it off as just an unusual development, but he'll grow out of it. And by the age of two, it's very clear the child has autism. In fact, in retrospective studies, it's been parents who more or less diagnosed the condition, knew that something was wrong with their child.
And what are the first things that people typically notice that alert them that there's something going on?
A lot of parents, especially parents who've had children before, say, this just doesn't feel like my previous babies. This child turns away from me when my other baby's cuddled up. This child doesn't look at me. This child sort of looks through me. This child doesn't respond to my attempts to engage him or her, seems indifferent to me. Those are some of the very, very subtle signs. Those definitely do not mean autism, but they should send a parent to a pediatrician to present their concerns.
We read three times as many boys as girls end up with autism. Do we know why?
No, I don't think anybody has a good answer for that, except that part of the early development of the brain is different for boys and for girls, and there may be more vulnerability on the male side. Also, the chromosomal differences, that the males may actually carry more of the vulnerability in their genes than the females do.
And you must be in touch with a lot of parents who are dealing with this in their family. What's the tenor of the conversation out there? Are people feeling like there's something going on that they and their child have been wounded by that's environmentally connected? What's the nature of the dialogue?
Well, we do have the parents who are first learning of their child's diagnosis. They're very, very young children who come to our organization looking for assistance. And, of course, it's just devastating, and that's a very, very sad moment for them. And they're coming to terms with something that has stolen all of their thoughts about what their child would be like. And then we see the kind of a next phase. There are parents who have sort of come to terms with that, and now they're sort of looking for the cure. And they might run through a whole gamut of really unproven things, strange diets and other things. Like you mentioned, the concern about environmental toxins. There's mm-hmm. a whole group of parents who are sending their children for chelation therapies that really haven't been...
Chelation is it detoxification?
Exactly, of heavy metals through the body, and carries a lot of side effects, but it hasn't really been shown in any significant way to cure autism. And then there's the next phase where they kind of come to terms with this, that this is something that's going to require a lot of work to improve, and it may not go away. And then finally, there's a group of parents who have come to terms with it, and these parents are often very, very strong advocates. In fact, we're blessed in our organization to have a number of parents who contribute a lot of their knowledge and expertise to how we run our programs.
I can imagine. Joseph Ricciardi, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Rick Rollins. He's joining us from Granite Bay, California. He's a father of an autistic son, co-founder of the MIND Institute, Medical Investigation of Neurodevelopment Disorders at the University of California at Davis, and is former secretary of the Senate for the state of California. Good evening and welcome, Rick Rollins.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us,
my pleasure.
Rick. Rick, you have surely been following the California situation closely. You saw the results of the new study that just came out last week saying this isn't some kind of false blip. There's a surge here. I don't know if you heard Marion Sigmund earlier saying they're not ready to call it an epidemic. You're living right in the middle of this. You see what you see. How does it look to you?
Well, I don't know what you call something that starts out in a prevalence of 2 to 5 per 10,000 children down to 1 in 150 kids over 20 years and not describe that as an epidemic. That's a 3,400% increase in prevalence in a disease that we once thought was extremely rare. The California study that just came out, paid for by the taxpayers of California, $1 million, three-year study, looked at factors into the cause of this astronomical increase in fully diagnosed level one, that is, worst-case autism cases here in California. And it's based on a study that came out from the Department of Developmental Services back in 1999, which showed that autism was increasing at a rate that surprised everyone. In fact, it was a 273% increase.
And that's what caught our attention. I mean, in medical terms, that's an enormous leap.
It is. And in fact, when you look at the population growth of California during that time, it was about 20%. Autism rose at 273%. And the other developmental disabilities that our system serves, that is, mental retardation, cerebral palsy, and epilepsy, they all rose as well, but at a very population-adjusted rate.
So what's going on here, Rick? We won't put you forward as a scientist, but you've clearly been paying a lot of attention as a parent. What's your sense?
Well, clearly, there's something going on. Remember, you know, you cannot have a genetic disease epidemic. Genes don't mutate this quickly to cause this kind of rise in such a devastating brain disorder. And I think where science is moving finally from the perspective of many of us parents is looking at this complex interaction between genes and the environment. And for many of us, the environment are vaccines. I testified 3 years ago before Congress about this issue of what happened to my son at 7 months old. And it's clear the immunizations caused his autism. And I hear this story from countless other parents throughout the country.
Your son, Russell, just celebrated his 12th birthday. When did autism come into his world, your world? When were you first aware of it?
Well, we saw what the reaction at 7 months old to his series of immunizations that he received.
And these are the same immunizations that all or most American children receive.
That's absolutely right, except what we have to keep in mind is what is contained in these immunizations as we continue to add more and more to the immunization schedule. We're talking about things like mercury, formaldehyde, aluminum, MSG, live viruses, killed bacteria, all in this witch's brew concoction that we give our kids here in California now, 39 doses before the age of 2 years old, without a single safety study looking at the interaction of all these potent chemicals and live viruses.
Rick Rollins, stand by. I want to turn to Dr. Bernard Rimland in San Diego, California. He's director of the Autism Research Institute and editor of the Autism Research Review, founder of the Autism Society of America. His son is 47 years old and he's had 45 years of experience researching autism. Good evening and welcome, Bernard Rimland.
Welcome to you.
Thanks for being with us. You're there in California as well. You've watched these numbers. And the great question is, why? What is your sense, Dr. Rimland, of what's going on here?
Well, let me say that I wrote an editorial for my newsletter back in 95 asking the question, is there an autism epidemic? It was quite clear at that time. And the answer I gave to my own question was, yes, there obviously is an autism epidemic. And it's taken 7 years for the establishment to finally recognize the very obvious fact that there is a huge epidemic, just as Rick Rollins has said.
So you're not waiting for another study. You see it right in front of your face.
It is extremely obvious. It is so obvious that I find it incredible that there's still people around doubting the reality of it.
Well, how would you describe this rate of growth in terms of incidence of a disease? I mean, is this something that, is it rare? Does it happen often?
When my son was born in 1956, our pediatrician had 35 years of experience. He had never seen nor heard of a child who did anything like, acted anything like our son Mark. Mm-hmm. I was 3 years beyond a PhD in psychology at that time. I had never seen the word autism or heard of an autistic child.
Well, there are a lot of things, though, that we didn't talk about that we weren't aware of in the 1950s, I suppose, that we are now. What about this awareness question? Is it just that we're more socially attuned, or you're saying it's something else?
Well, that's one of the questions that was addressed in the California study that Rick Rollins, whom you just spoke with, had a great deal did a great service by getting the state of California to produce. Mm-hmm. They checked out those questions. Those kinds of excuses were being given by the medical establishment for the rise. They said it was an increase in awareness. It was a change in diagnostic standards. It was people coming into California from other states to get better services. Mm-hmm. And they explicitly addressed those questions, and the answers to those questions clearly do not even begin to account for the increase. And that's why the medical establishment has reluctantly admitted, finally, that there is an epidemic.
So if it's not genetic, if the increase is not genetic, as Rick Rollins asserts, and I'd like your view on that, are somehow children paying the price for the American lifestyle, for the American medical regimen? What's your best sense of what's going on?
I certainly agree that genes play an important part in autism. My book, Infantile Autism, was published way back in 64. I was very unpopular because I said that genetics had a very large role to play in the genesis of autism.
But how would that play into a spike in numbers?
Very, very easily. The genetics of autism include, apparently, the best guess we have is that they include a sensitivity to certain substances in the environment, including the mercury in vaccines. Mercury is included in the vaccines in enormous amounts.
Do you mean that the mercury in a vaccine that the parent received would actually change what's transmitted, or that the genetics of the living child are somehow altered by the vaccine?
The upsurge in autism is essentially in the late onset cases. When my child was born, almost all the cases of autism were early onset cases.
What window?
It was present at birth. You could see the child would not adjust to the parents. Mm-hmm. He would not look at people. It was early onset. It was a different kind of autism. The autism, which is extremely prevalent now, which accounts for the upsurge, is late onset autism, and it occurs in kids after they have been vaccinated.
Bernard Rimland, stand by. Joseph Ricciardi, Rick Rollins. A lot of callers want to join us tonight. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. It's Tony.
Tony, I'm sorry. Welcome, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is I have an autistic son, actually, who's 5 years old.
Okay.
And I'm a doctor myself, and I follow this literature with great interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate what all these people are saying, because, like in the case of Dr. Rimland, he's devoted his life to autism, and I very much appreciate these folks' work.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with the overall thrust of the program, though.
On the notion that numbers are spiking up, or the notion that there's maybe an environmental cause?
Both. I don't think that there's any real epidemic of autism, and I don't think that there's an environmental cause. I think that autism is genetic, and I think there's increased recognition. And I think that the authors of the California study erroneously came to the conclusion, or at least they portray it as showing that there is a, quote, epidemic, when in fact their data really shows increased recognition.
Why, from the distance that you're looking at this, why do you feel confidence to conclude that, Tony?
Okay. Because, well, first of all, I believe it was Dr. Sigmund made a qualifying statement saying, we can't say from our study that this is an epidemic.
And yes, they did. An awareness issue was the unquantified factor here.
Exactly, because they sampled people who were already in the system. They didn't sample the general population of California. If you look at their actual data, the later cohort, the patients with autism who were born later, who supposedly represent the epidemic, are actually very different in nature than the earlier cohort, in the sense that, for example, there's more girls, there's almost double the number of Hispanic patients, and there's people from a lower socioeconomic status.
Tony, we've got it. I want to turn that to Bernard Rimland. Dr. Rimland, what's your response? Tony's a doctor. He has a child, a son who's autistic. He says, not an epidemic, not environmentally caused.
Well, I just totally agree with him. And, you know, as he recognizes, I've studied this for a great many decades. I'm a professional researcher. I'm a full-time researcher. I've been a full-time professional researcher my entire adult life, about 50 years. And I know statistics. I've taught statistics. I know research design. And I totally agree with his conclusions.
You agree?
I totally disagree.
Disagree, yes. I would have thought so.
I agree with the California report in that there certainly is an epidemic. I disagree with it in that they give insufficient credit, if that's the word, blame, to vaccines. They just mention it in passing when, in fact, there's overwhelming evidence, as Rick Rollins says, that the vaccines are the only plausible and the very, very likely, almost certainly certain culprit here.
That's frightening.
May I interject?
Rick Rollins, please.
This is Joe Ricciardi.
Oh, I'm sorry, Joseph, excuse me.
Dr. Rindlin, the researcher herself qualified to say that she wouldn't use the words epidemic. She also qualified to say that she couldn't know for sure that the increase didn't represent just increased awareness. And the fact that some of these cases represent outside of what you would typically see in distribution of male to female and other socioeconomic strata would suggest that awareness and outreach is responsible for some increased rates. Also, you do have this audience of people who are brought into the system versus the general population. I think those are just good epidemiological concerns about then concluding that it's an epidemic. What do you think about that?
Bernard Rindlin.
Well, Dr. Sigmund was certainly not the researcher. She was one of a committee. Rick would probably be able to tell us. But she was not the primary researcher by any means. She was just one of a review committee. And I doubt that her views reflect those of the rest of the committee. Maybe Rick could address that.
Rick Rollins?
Yeah, hi.
Is the committee have a united front in saying no epidemic here?
No, there is no committee. There was a group of epidemiologists, which Marion Sigmund is not an epidemiologist, and she was not part of this study. She has her own personal views about autism, and she's entitled to those. But keep in mind that California's developmental services system was established in 1969. We've been in the business in the state of diagnosing autism for three decades. Mm. And in order for these children to be counted in our system, they must receive a professional diagnosis of level 1 DSM-4 autism. Mm-hmm. These numbers that we've reported do not include PDD, NOS, or Asperger's syndrome. These are only the worst cases of autism.
This is the real deal. Tony, thank you for your call. Joy's calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a child who was born in California. Mm-hmm. We now live in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another son who was born in the Midwest. My
mm-hmm.
son, who was born in California, has a very mild version of autism.
All right.
And I was wondering, is there something different in California as far as the inoculations or treatment of children that would increase their chances of having autism?
We should have an answer for you on that front. Bernard Rindlin.
There's nothing unusual about the practices in California. Each child is different from every other child in their vulnerability to these vaccines. The children vary from day to day in the susceptibility of their immune system. The child has a cold, for example, his immune system is somewhat down, and he may respond much differently to the vaccines than he would have a week earlier or a week later. And so the differences in the place where the kid was vaccinated in terms of the site of the, not of the vaccine, but where you lived at the time, would have nothing of it to do, at least with the whether or not.
So it's the same. It's the same vaccine nationwide, not special to California.
Yes,
I would beg. This is Rick Rollins. I would beg to differ a little bit on that. California has probably the most aggressive immunization schedule in the country. We have just added, in fact, the chickenpox vaccine recently, and the hepatitis A vaccine, which will come into play very shortly. So
I thought those were rejected.
And no, they were not. They were they were both approved. And in fact, California has one of the highest immunization rates in the country. But more importantly, even than that, I think, is to take a look at the country. I mean, this study does not in any way isolate California from the rest of the country.
Rick Rollins, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back and look at it. Joseph Ricciardi, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Joseph Ricciardi is Vice President of Clinical Training and Education at the May Institute. We're talking tonight about big numbers of autism. Some of our guests tonight say an epidemic of autism in California, and if it's there, maybe around the country, has it touched you or your family? What is going on here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston uses to get their flu and pneumonia shots.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about big numbers of autism in California. Maybe an epidemic there. Maybe an epidemic in the country. Has the surge touched you or your family? What is going on here? Is there something disturbingly contemporary about an affliction that hits our human software and the software, the minds of our children? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Rick Rollins, father of an autistic son, former Secretary of the Senate for the state of California, and co-founder of the MIND Institute, Medical Investigation of Neurodevelopmental Disorders at the University of California at Davis, and by Dr. Bernard Rimlin, Director of the Autism Research Institute, Editor of the Autism Research Review, and Founder of the Autism Society of America. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Anne's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to state a few things that I have noticed in the last few years. I have a grandson who has autism, and it's a mild case of autism, but it still is autism. He was diagnosed with that when he was 3 years old. Up until the time he was 3 years old, he was fine.
So his parents and you were not worried about him before that time?
We were not aware about anything at all. I mean, he laughed, he giggled, he played, he did all of the things that a child normally does.
He wasn't avoiding eye contact, none of that?
Right. No, he was a loving child, and we noticed that he was having a speech problem, and we had a problem potty training him, and of course then we took him in right away. But I guess what my point is that not only did he have a case of autism, but a friend of my daughter had two children with autism, and just the other day, a friend of mine who had a wonderful little three-year-old grandson told me now he has it.
So you're seeing a lot in your immediate circle. What's your question here, Ann?
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is, or what I'm thinking is, there must be something that's going on that all of these children reach about the age of three, and all of a sudden they all start having these problems. And what I am seeing is an epidemic, and I see where our school system is going to be taxed to the limit, because already with my grandson I can see where there's a lot of problems and there aren't enough people that are going to be able to handle these children when they get into the public school system.
I'm sure that must be the case already in many communities, but Anne, thank you for your call. Dr. Rimlin, what about this? Anne's saying, do we see more instances of autism coming on at a later age? Is age three considered late onset?
That's exactly right. If you query the parents closely, you'd probably find that the kids were vaccinated relatively short time before the autism occurred. We hear this all the time. And the school districts all over the country are just going frantic trying to deal with all these new cases.
So are you, I want to get to this vaccine question. Are you suggesting that somehow the country as a whole is running roughshod over this issue, just continuing to do the vaccinations, doesn't want to pay attention to the potential autism risk because it would get in the way of the immunization program, or what?
I'm not suggesting it. I'm asserting it, stating it as emphatically as I possibly can. That is extremely true. Yes, the evidence has been accumulating for a long time. The FDA and the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association.
Who would have an interest in ignoring this if it's so clear?
Because they have enormous legal responsibility, liability. There are class action lawsuits cropping up all over the country, just as there are in the UK, where they're having the very same problem. It's an epidemic in many places.
And the government, you're saying, is incented not to pay full attention, to be fully frank about it. Megan's calling from Boston. Hi, Megan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for
taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm actually a researcher. I'm not a researcher. I'm a student at the University, Tufts University School of Medicine. I'm currently doing a research project on the connection between MMR and autism. And the
this
thing
is measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and autism. And what are you seeing?
Right. And the thing that I'm finding the most prevalent amongst talking to parents of who have children with autism is their feeling of there being a connection between gastrointestinal problems and having what you consider to be like a leaky gut. In other words, diarrhea, stomach problems, stomach pain, vomiting associated with autism that they also sort of think is because of the MMR vaccine. And I wonder.
I'm not sure how you pull that. I just want to be sure I understand. You're saying that in advance of the vaccination or after the vaccination, how does the gastrointestinal come into play?
After the vaccination, parents feel that their children are experiencing extreme gastrointestinal problems, and that they also feel that is brought on because of the MMR vaccine, and therefore maybe it might be the gastrointestinal problems that are causing the autism. The parents seem to be confused about that connection.
Dr. Rimlin, can you weigh in?
Yes, that's the observations she's making are precisely the observations that have been reported repeatedly in the U.S. as well as in the U.K. The MMR vaccine is frequently, very frequently, associated with these gastrointestinal upsets and autism. One of the problems is that the mercury and the MMR vaccine does not contain mercury, but the other vaccines do, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
The mercury destroys segments of the gastrointestinal tract lining, the mucous membrane.
Mm-hmm.
It allows viruses to lodge in that membrane, especially the virus for the measles. And the measles virus has been found in the gastrointestinal tracts of autistic children as compared, in a number of studies, as compared to normal children.
So you're suggesting that the vaccine introduces the measles virus somehow through the intestinal tract, which can lead to autism.
The vaccines by the mercury in the previous vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That mechanism, as far as I'm concerned, is very, very, very solidly established.
Heather's calling. Hi, Heather. You're on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Heather, and I am a U.S. citizen who's recently returned to the U.S., having lived in the U.K. most of my life.
All right.
I have a child with autism.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody made a point earlier on about it may be regionalized to California. This is simply not true. The National Autistic Society in Britain is reporting up to 1 in 86 elementary kids with autism. How anybody could miss these kids and say it's down to better diagnosis
mm-hmm.
beggars belief.
Mm-hmm.
And for those listeners thinking, well, it's okay, I got away with it, it's not my kid, you know.
Right, my son or daughter's past age 3.
Yeah, okay, it's not your kid. But you know what, guys? We've got to really think about the future. Because our kids, the typical kids, are going to be having to look after these kids because there are so many of them now.
Heather, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Rick Rollins, you know the humble rumble world of politics. How does this get put up on the American screen in such a way that it's dealt with, if indeed it's being ducked right now, as Dr. Rimland suggests?
Well, I need to add a comment about the fact that, if autism has not touched you personally yet, it likely will, and it is touching your pocketbook. What's so remarkable here in this state, just to give you a figure from California,
mm-hmm.
every day in California, we're adding, on average, 9 new children with fully diagnosed DSM-4 autism to our Regional Center Developmental Services system.
What's the impact of that?
Our Department of Developmental Services estimates for every new child that gets added to the system, it's going to cost taxpayers at least $2 million for a lifetime of care.
So why is the government ducking if it's ducking?
Now keep in mind that the National Institutes of Health claims that they spend $56 million a year on autism research.
Mm-hmm.
There are many of us who have looked over what they call autism research and have some serious concerns about that number being a bit inflated. But even, let's say it is $56 million for the sake of argument, what that equates to literally is 3 days worth of children in the state of California, because we're adding 9 kids a day at $2 million apiece. $18 million a day times 3, $54 million.
Mm-hmm.
3 days
mm-hmm.
worth of children from one state.
Better to step up and lick it. Rick Rollins, I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, but you really opened our eyes tonight. There's a lot more to think about here. I want to thank you for coming on and spending this time with us. We'll come back to it.
My pleasure. The final chapter of this saga is far from being written, and I think as time goes on, we will unravel the mysteries of this disorder.
You've made it very clear, and thank you for being with us. Rick Rollins, father of an autistic son, is co-founder of the MIND Institute. He joined us from Granite Bay, California. And Dr. Bernard Rimland, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My great pleasure.
Bernard Rimland is director of the Autism Research Institute and founder of the Autism Society of America. His son, with autism, is now 47 years old. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. This is On Point. Until age 4, Stephen Shore was unable to speak as a result of his autism. Today, at age 41, he is 6 months away from earning his doctorate in special education at Boston University. Shore suffers from Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism. His story, which he captured in the book Beyond the Wall, has inspired parents of autistic children across the country. In this radio diary, Stephen Shore reflects on his remarkable journey from autistic child to future PhD.
I didn't get hit with what I call the autism bomb until age 18 months.
And it was that time that I changed from a normally developing child, developing physically, developing verbal abilities, and the autism bomb hit. I lost my ability to speak, had tantrums, got involved in self-stimulatory activities such as spinning and some hand flapping. And it was at 2.5 that I was evaluated by a school that said that they had never seen a child so sick, and they recommended institutionalization. They said, no way, we're not going to do that. We know that there's a bright child in here. We can't see that happening. So it was really to my parents that I have to give credit to for at least giving me the initial impetus for me to get to where I am today. By age 4, I had started learning how to talk again, and that's when I was finally admitted to that special school that initially said that I should be sent away. First of all, I entered regular public school kindergarten at age 6. It was pretty much a social and academic disaster. Children who are different get teased, so there was certainly a lot of bullying. The teachers didn't quite know what to do with me, so I was usually half a grade to a whole grade behind in math and reading. One teacher told me that I'd never be able to do math, but somehow I figured out enough math to teach the statistics over at Emerson College. I'd say it took me until about 6th grade for me to finally figure out on my own what I needed to do in order to get good grades. What did teachers need in order to respond with good grades in return? And how do I interact with my classmates in such a way that the interactions are meaningful and successful? Well, at this point, I've pretty much self-accommodate for my condition. For example, dealing with unstructured information is difficult. In a class that I took, I had difficulty just trying to figure out what the structure of a qualitative study was. And it wasn't until I went home and diagrammed it out in pictures, kind of in a flow chart, that I was able to figure out for myself, oh, this is the process, this is what a qualitative study looks like. So basically what I have to do is when I am in a class and when I'm taking notes, I need to convert the notes into graphical form. I still have some sensory sensitivities. Shaving for me feels like scraping a power sander across my face. It's just utterly painful. So my accommodation is to grow a beard. I find public transportation in Boston just sensorially overwhelming, and the accommodation for that is to ride my bicycle. And I think it's important for everybody on the autism spectrum to determine where their challenges are. And what we need to do is arrange our lives in such a way that we can speak to our strengths to accommodate for our challenges. Socialization certainly was difficult when I was younger. It can be difficult now. And in particular, what I call unstructured social events, such as an office party, for example. And what I do if I'm in such a situation is I find something for me to do, and that could be playing the piano, and I can direct my interactions through being the piano person. I think it's important to realize that an autism spectrum diagnosis is not a static diagnosis. So you may have a child that's running around and flapping their hands and being nonverbal and perhaps having tantrums at age 2.5, but maybe by age 5 or 6 or so, they've got most of their language back. There's still some difficulties in school, but they're getting along. And as things go on, as they mature, as they learn more how to, you almost might say, live with themselves and understand their strengths and challenges, they can go through college and then lead fulfilling and productive lives.
Stephen Shore will receive his doctorate from Boston University in May. He is the author of Beyond the Wall, Personal Experiences with Autism and Asperger's Syndrome. Stephen Shore, you have our applause. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.